Okay. I think that concludes our pre-interview. Great job.
Are you part Canadian?
No, I'm not. I'm not. Okay. Why do you ask?
I don't know. You have a funny sense of humor. That's very Canadian-ish.
Speaking of, happy Canada Day, eh?
Thank you.
You got any plans? You're going to go skating with the boys or what?
See, you're nailing it.
Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinle & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, director of content at Steinle. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. My guest today is jazz pianist and Steinle artist Chris Davis, who was recently named Downbeat Magazine's Pianist of the Year. She spoke to me on Canada Day following a performance at Big Ears Festival, where Steinle is the official piano. What I love about your music, there's a real attention to a slow build during your performances. There's this buildup of energy and tension throughout a jam, and then it comes to a head. And I thought you did that real effectively with your crew at Big Ears.
Oh, thank you.
Would you say that's something that you focus on, or is that something that happens naturally as a result of how you lay things out?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of storytelling in my music, and we're in a phase of, you know, social media where everything kind of hits you in like 30 seconds or less. And it's really a different thing when you're performing a concert and you've got an hour long set, you know, and you've got to kind of tell the story. And if you give it all away right in the first 30 seconds, you know, there's not much left to say. So there is an element of revealing things, you know, over time, which are built into the compositions, but also in free improvisation with the trio.
What's the process of creating a tune with your band? What does that look like for you?
It's a tricky question because every tune has its own sort of process and way in. But usually the composition process, it starts with me getting inspired by something I've heard. So I might be listening to some music. It usually happens when I'm out walking. Yeah, just something like a part of a piece or something that grabs me. And then I'll take that idea and like kind of boil it down to like what the essence of that idea is, and sometimes blend it with something else that I'm really into as well. Like, for example, there was a piece on my record and a piece that we played at Big Ears called Little Footsteps. And that's a combination of a melody by Steve Lacy on the tune The Flame and a Beyonce bass line that I really like, and then some Cecil Taylor kind of chords. So I kind of like mash these things in and then build structure around them.
Yeah, I like that. And I can hear that too. I can hear sort of the contemporary classic mix in your tunes. What goes into your jazz mix? I mean, you're able to say Steve Lacy and Beyonce in the same breath. What, when you were coming up, still sticks with you?
When I was 13, I decided that I was going to be a jazz musician. And basically, it was from hearing Herbie Hancock play on the Miles Davis record, My Funny Valentine, Four and More. And I just love the way that he played and interacted with Tony Williams. That always really stuck with me. So I would say like Herbie and his like feel, time feel and phrasing is really like still very much part of the way that I play, even though I have many more influences. Herbie's like at kind of at the core of my time feel, especially.
I saw him at the Big Ears the year before, and it's striking. I mean, it's almost too obvious to say, but he's such a great listener.
Such a great listener, yeah.
Yeah, tell our listeners what being a great listener means quantitatively in jazz.
One thing is just like listening, but also intuiting like when to play. Like Herbie is the best comper. Mm-hmm. You know, the pianist is the comper in the band, accompanying, playing rhythms and harmony to support the soloist. And he's just a master at that, like how he intuits with where the solo is going, how to support it and give the soloist ideas, but without getting in the way. That's super difficult. And he's just, you know, he's a master.
I think he has that famous story. He played a wrong chord, and then Miles played a note that made his chord sound right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really changed his strategy to listening to people in the moment.
In the middle of one of the songs, during Miles' solo, I played this chord that was so wrong. I thought I had just destroyed everything and reduced that great night to rubble. Miles took a breath, and he played some notes, and he made my chord right. And I could not figure out how he did that. It sounded like magic, you know? It took me years to figure out what actually happened. Here's what happened. I judged what I had played. Miles didn't. Miles just accepted it as something new that happened. And he did what any jazz musician should always try to do, and that is try to make anything that happens into something of value.
Yeah, and that's incredible also like on Miles' part, you know, to support the comper. Because it really is a conversation and a collaborative process when you're supporting a soloist. And when I moved to New York, you know, I grew up in Calgary and went to school in Toronto for jazz piano. And then I moved to New York and got into sort of more free improvisation. And I sort of found that the things that I learned, you know, as a jazz pianist, as a comper, they didn't really help me when we're trying to create kind of collaborative improvisations, you know, with your bandmates. Because I was always kind of driving the harmony and I didn't like that feeling. I wanted it to be collaborative. I wanted the saxophonist to be able to set up harmony and build it together. So for a while, you know, after a few years of being in New York, I just stopped going to see pianists and just thought, let me just get the piano out of my ears, other people's sounds and their approaches to the instrument, and see if I can, you know, find influences through other instrumentation, through other styles and genres of music.
To become a better listener, you took some time off from your instrument and tried to see things from the perspective of other instruments.
Yeah, I mean, I was still like playing and practicing, but I was thinking about the piano instead of a harmonic instrument, thinking about, you know, if I'm going to see like bands with two horns in them, you know, how might I approach playing the piano like two horns, you know? Or if I see like a drum and bass, you know, duo, like how might I use that as information to approach the piano? And then that kind of led into contemporary classical music, where I was hearing like Ligeti's like atmospheres and trying to like, how do I create that sound on the piano? Or for example, Messiaen's, you know, bird call pieces. That's a good example of where he took these bird calls and figured out how to apply them to the piano. So that was always really inspiring to me. So I was trying to always like get away from the pianistic influences of Herbie, of Keith Jarrett, all these wonderful pianists that really had an impact on me, but I had to kind of get away from them to figure out who I wanted to be at the piano.
I've definitely spoken with classical musicians who view the piano not as a piano, but as an orchestra. So that when they're playing a solo piano piece, they're thinking, oh, okay, this is my string section. This is my brass. These are my woodwinds.
Yeah. And when I've kind of come back to playing, you know, jazz, playing more sort of straight ahead jazz over forms, over chord changes, that's the mentality I'm coming into it with now. It's like, oh, can I comp like a whole flute section of an orchestra. So it's less sort of this kind of shell voicings as a jazz pianist and more like what you're saying, this more orchestral approach to accompanying.
Jazz is about improvisation. What do you think about, do you think anything when you're playing or soloing? Or is the idea that the preparation permits you not to do a ton of thinking in the moment and just react?
I mean, it definitely is about the preparation and trying to just be totally in the moment. You can't come into playing improvisation and have a preconceived idea of what you're going to do or how the other people are going to play and how you react. You know, anytime we do that, like sometimes if you're practicing maybe some kind of line or lick that you're trying to get into your hands, and then you bring that in and like always inject it into the improvisation or the band, it just never really works.
Yeah, that's corny. I hear that's corny.
it's not impactful. But when you sort of find that thing in the moment, you know, as you're sort of letting go of all the things you're practicing and just really being present and creating with the people around you, yeah, you kind of rely on all the things that you've been working on, the knowledge, the experience.
Were there discoveries that you've made over the years? One would appear to be your listening closer to horns, that sort of thing. But were there discoveries over the years that influenced you to change your approach to music or your approach to the piano?
Yeah, definitely. I think harmonically, you know, I love harmony. I play piano. but there was this idea of like, you know, especially listening to someone like Cecil Taylor or some of the contemporary classical composers like Morton Feldman, where the chords were more about the construction of them, like how close the intervals were, you know, inside the chord, how wide things might be, where these chords fall on the piano and how range affects the sound. You know, these discoveries were all very exciting to me when I started to put them into the music that I was playing as an improviser and composer. You know, I sometimes give the example, like I'll play this kind of cluster, a chord, and you know, you can kind of put any bass note under that and it just creates another kind of color around the chord. And I like that idea of almost like anything works, you know, it's just about colors and textures. And really like the decision making is around rhythm, around melody, and sort of less around harmonic construction.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bassist's whole game, right? Changing colors by changing the root.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, maybe that's why I play with so many bass players. They're happy to be free of of being locked into like, play the right note under this chord. Because it all kind of works, you know.
Talked about Herbie's collaboration with Tony Williams, and I'm interested in the drum piano relationship, because as a guy who plays both instruments badly, I've never really thought too hard about the relation between piano and drums without the bass. I sort of would see all three as a rhythm section. But what is it that struck you about Herbie and Tony's interaction?
I think it was the rhythmic interplay. Again, they were kind of intuiting where the other was going and supporting rhythmically. So I just like that conversation, especially through rhythm and piano and drums. There's a long tradition of that conversation. And I feel super fortunate that I've had a chance to play with some amazing drummers and drummers without bass players. So like I played in a trio with Taish Ansori and Ingrid Laubrock called Paradoxical Frog with no bass. And it was just totally free to play around you know, with rhythm, also with range and timbre. It opened things up, not having the bass in there.
So speaking of orchestrations, you have a forthcoming album with string quartet. How did this collaboration come about?
I was commissioned by the Jazz to Pad Festival in Wrocław, Poland, to write for the string quartet called the Ludoslawski Quartet. Wonderful quartet, mostly kind of in the classical realm, although I think they're playing more improvised music lately. So I play with them, and I wrote some music for them and re-recorded it last year, and that's coming out in January of 2026. Walking the line of written material and improvisation. And, you know, it's interesting, like when you're writing for classical players, there's not the same, in my experience, the same kind of mentality around improvisation. Sometimes players are like, I don't know what to do because they're so used to reading and executing things at a high level that the idea of like composing or improvising in the moment actually goes back to what you were saying about storytelling, you know, being able to create tension, build a story with limited elements. So sometimes I'll write things for them, little pieces for them to use, language for them to build on so that they have something to kind of play and develop.
So was this music, how much of it was through composed? Are there outlines and then some squiggles in the middle for improv? Or what does that look like on the score?
That's funny. I teach graphic scores, but I'm not the biggest fan of playing graphic scores. So I like the idea of breaking away from the mold and using visual elements. But yeah, I don't write so many in my pieces. I would say like 60% of it's written, 40% improvised, and there's different kinds of challenges. Some are, you know, explore the certain kinds of maybe glissandos or something in a section that's really short and then jumps to a part that's composed. And then someone else has something's written, and then, you know, two of the strings improvise over that written part. So there's those kinds of challenges. And then there's challenges where there's some material written and we really improvise just using that material through the piece. And then there's other things that are totally through composed. This one piece kind of builds up to this very high point, and then it's like I've led them to the top of the mountain, and then they have to figure out how to get down. So they have to improvise harmonically, you know, together as a quartet, which they're very good at. It's familiar space to them to kind of find their way out harmonically and improvise together.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Little Footsteps from the Chris Davis Trio album Run the Gauntlet on Pyroclastic Records, the title track from My Funny Valentine, Miles Davis Live in Concert on Sony BMG, from Herbie Hancock speaking on Masterclass, from Heavy Footed from Run the Gauntlet, and from An Invitation to Disappear from Chris Davis's forthcoming album The Solastalgia Suite, with the Ludoslawski Quartet. Our opening and closing music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, played on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard, message me on Facebook at Steinway, or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears Festival. Thank you for listening.